In the fall of 2019, a class had two teaching assistants, one male and one female. At the end of the semester, the students scored the male TA higher on course evaluations, while the female TA got five times as many negative reviews. Now, there's just one problem in this whole scenario. They were both the same person. That person was Emily Kazan, a PhD candidate in interdisciplinary ecology at the University of Florida School of Natural Resources and Environment. She led the team that wrote the report on the project, which is soon to be published in the journal North American Colleges and Teachers of Agriculture. Emily Kazan is here to talk about the study along with one of her fellow authors, Jesse Borden, also a PhD candidate in interdisciplinary ecology at UF. I asked Emily first why a specialist in interdisciplinary ecology took on this topic.
Yeah, well, this was a side project. So my dissertation is on butterfly community ecology and physiology. But I've been a graduate student for a long time during my master's and, of course, now in my PhD. And this idea has been something that I've thought a lot about, that I've experienced in different ways. I've had a lot of conversations with both male and female colleagues about it. And being assigned to a really large asynchronous online class, I thought, well, this is an awesome opportunity to actually be able to test it.
And had you had much anecdotal evidence going in that this was a problem?
In my own personal life, yes, absolutely. But, you know, we don't want to do things just based on a personal hunch. I also delved into the literature and saw that there are plenty of studies that document bias in teaching evaluations against women, against people of color, et cetera. So there was evidence to support the study and the study design. And yes, I would say that personally and based on plenty of interactions and conversations, I had seen evidence of this happening, and enough so to, I think, warrant the study that we did.
Does the world, according to COVID, make this an easier study to do?
Yeah, I think COVID and sort of the increase in online learning is going to make replicating this study design really easy. So the course was designed like this even before COVID. It's always been, or at least ever the last several years that I've been helping be a TA with it, it's been an online asynchronous course. With COVID, of course, we're getting a lot more of those. So it increases the opportunity to do these quote unquote deceit studies where the students don't fully know what's going on behind the scenes.
And Jesse, how are you involved with this?
Yeah, I'm lucky to have gotten to be involved with this. Mostly just got involved with it because I'm friends with Emily and we had talked about these things for quite some time and different experiences she had had. And I've been on a learning journey for quite a few years now, learning my place of privilege as a white, heterosexual, cisgender male. And yeah, we just shared a lot of conversations. And when the study design came up, I was thrilled to get to be a part of it. So I mostly just volunteered my identity, like Emily said, but then we all worked together as a team to kind of talk through the design and the questionnaire and how do we do the analysis and things like that.
So Emily, how did you go about doing it? First of all, what types of classes were involved in this?
So this was one course. It's an upper division natural resource ecology course. So it's kind of a mix between conservation biology and ecology. The course had 136 students in it, so it was a large enough course to split in half. The way we split it in half kind of randomly with respect to last name and tried to make sure that it fell out with a reasonably equal number of male and female students in both groups. And then conducting the study, like I said, each student was assigned to a TA, so I knew which students to grade under the auspices of which TA. I had my computer monitors set up and I would randomize as best as I could. I would just kind of switch it up and have a poor enough short-term memory that I couldn't remember what I had done the day before. So it didn't really matter of having, you know, Emily's students on one monitor and Jesse's students on another monitor. And I would start grading randomly within that list each time. And I would sort of grade one or two on one side and grade one or two on the other side so that the grading effort was equal, so that my fatigue was the same. You know, the last five students I graded for Jesse were graded at the same time as the last five for Emily. So if a grader is fatigued and either giving better or worse scores because they're fatigued, at least that was all even across the board.
Did you find yourself subtly changing the way you communicated with the students? Is it, well, I got to be a guy now?
Yeah, so I was concerned about that potential, which is why I randomized sort of where I was looking. So when I was Emily, I wasn't always looking at my right monitor, and Jesse always at my left monitor. That changed around all the time. So the students had multiple assignments, and because of the number of students, I would grade, you know, the same assignment over the course of a few days, just because there were so many of them. And by randomizing which side I was Emily and which side I was Jesse, that helped me. I didn't even know who I was supposed to be for each one, because I wanted that to be as blind as possible. So I didn't look at the student's name because I did not want to be swayed in any unconscious way that I would grade them one way or the other based on what they're called. Likewise, with what I was being called, I didn't pay attention to that because I didn't want any of my potential implicit biases to shine through. And I think that our experimental design really allowed for that lack of bias and really allowed for sort of randomization with respect to who I was at any given moment.
Well, we've kind of buried the lead here. So what did you find? How big a difference was there?
Well, when we looked at the data, so all of the aggregate scores, and I want to note that Likert data, so that classic strongly agree to strongly disagree survey that we're all very familiar with, there's a couple different ways to skin that cat. There are a couple different ways to interpret and analyze those data. And the way that Jesse and I and the rest of the team converged on analyzing it was incredibly conservative, right? So we wanted to make sure that we weren't manipulating those results in a way that was statistically unsound. And so what we found, just eyeballing the data, was like a kind of a strange dip in scores when we looked at female students ranking their female TA. That, to me at least, was quite notable. And in fact, it was 100% of females assigned to their male TA, quote unquote, ranked him positively, whereas only 88% of the female students assigned to the quote unquote female TA ranked her favorably. That in and of itself was a bit of a stark result. When we ran the appropriate statistics on those data, there's not a statistically significant outcome. So researchers are really into P is less than 0.05. And this frequentist statistic is a really useful tool. But we try to explain that while we don't meet a specific statistical cutoff, the results and the visualization of the results and the fact that I am one single person that received what looks like pretty different scores, that's significant in and of itself. That's of social significance. And we discuss in the paper that, you know, hiring committees and promotion committees, they're not comparing two candidates by running statistics on a slew of scores that they've received over their teaching career or research career, right? They're looking at these scores just on a single score on a piece of paper. And so understanding that male scores can be higher than female scores and why that might be is important regardless of the statistical cutoff. And so, yeah, we found it seems that despite me being only one person, when I pretended to be a male, I got kind of higher scores from my students, particularly female students, than when I presented as myself.
I was going to say, did you find the same difference in the male students?
There was a much smaller degree of intra-gender bias in male students. So while the female data is much more stark, particularly when you see it plotted, how we have it in our paper, you can see a subtle difference in males in that the scores were ever so slightly lower for the male TA than the female TA.
So this is more than just, you know, a fun little statistic to find. These reviews have real world consequences, don't they?
They certainly do. And I would say, as somebody who has, as I mentioned, I've been a TA for many, many semesters of my life, I can tell you that on a personal note, and I've heard this from colleagues, both male and female, if somebody receives a really negative review from a student, that never feels good, right? So we are always, as a teacher, as an educator, as an academic, as a scholar, I want people that are my students to understand the subject material, to appreciate it, and to have a positive experience with me. So receiving negative scores is always a bit of a shot personally to someone. But then again, with respect to hiring prospects, promotion prospects, et cetera, it's important that this phenomenon be noticed so that we don't have women unnecessarily missing out on opportunities for forward movement and growth in their careers.
And who is paying attention to this research now? Who is this, you know, are the right eyeballs seeing this?
It seems to have seen quite a few eyes, which is really awesome. Jesse and I have talked about how it's a little amusing as well that we both have sort of dedicated our academic research careers to ecophysiology of various animals. But this one sort of side project study is definitely getting a lot more attention than any of our ecology or physiology work. But yes, it's been retweeted. It's been discussed in classes, apparently, very widely. The internet is a really weird place that has definitely decided that this study is worth discussing, which is important. And I think that as a team, we really hope that this just adds to the large conversation and evolving conversation about diversity and equity in academia.
Like Emily's saying, it's gotten a lot of attention. And one of the things that it has made me feel aware of, which I've been so aware of generally in the last few months, as we've watched so many different areas of science be scrutinized by the public, is that I hope that people can go and actually read the actual paper, because there's something very different between actually reading a paper and how it can be presented in different spheres. And I often find that people like to grab onto a paper and say, oh, look, this is proof for this, or this is not proof for that. And that's just not how science tends to work. The piece of work then gets added into this body of literature, which helps to inform kind of a broader understanding of whatever the subject matter is. And so even though we didn't find statistically significant results, which you can interpret a variety of different ways, one way that I think it could be interpreted is that we see possibly that online learning, where you have this distance of removal, may dull biases that people have. Or it could be an indication that in this particular area of study, the next generation is less biased inherently than the generation in the past. But given those levels of removal, the pattern that we did see, I found to be interesting.
I genuinely appreciate all of the attention that this paper has received, and I think it's warranted. I'm not certain how much I'm going to carry on working with human subjects. I do like my butterflies, but I'm really glad to have opened that door and peered through. And it's never off the table to continue in this line of research.
Even if we don't end up doing further research, this is obviously a topic that we will continue talking about in our professional spheres of influence, because it's very important both to be studied and also just to be openly examined and looked at.
Emily Kazan and Jesse Borden are both PhD candidates in interdisciplinary ecology at the University of Florida School of Natural Resources and Environment. Their study will soon be published in the journal North American Colleges and Teachers of Agriculture. Still to come, how did the Lincoln Normal School, a school for freed slaves in Marion, Alabama, evolve into Alabama State University? A conversation with the archivist who researched that story next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Alabama State University is a groundbreaking historically black university in Montgomery, Alabama. But while the history of the school will tell you it was founded in 1867, that's not quite the case. That year, the school was established, but as the Lincoln Normal School in Marion, Alabama, through the efforts of 9 former slaves. These men are known as the Marion 9 and are rightly considered the fathers of the university. It took their drive and perseverance in facing the challenges posed by a racial and political culture bent on preventing the establishment of black schools and universities that brought the school to life. The story of the origins of Alabama State University is told in the new book. It's called From Marion to Montgomery, The Early Years of Alabama State University, 1867 to 1925. It's written by Joseph D. Caver. It tells the story of the Lincoln Normal School and its transformation into this legendary institution, including the school's move to Montgomery in 1887 and evolution from normal school to junior college to full-fledged four-year university. Joseph Caver is a former senior archivist at the Air Force Historical Research Agency at Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery and was the first African-American archivist at the Alabama Department of Archives and History. He is currently a history lecturer at Alabama State University. I asked him about his interest in the history of this school.
Well, I was the first black archivist for the state of Alabama. In 1975, I was hired, and we had just celebrated the centennial of the university. And an Auburn University student, grad student, said they got it all wrong over at Alabama State. She took me up in the archives to the American Missionary Association papers, and I found the incorporation documents of the Lincoln School at Marion. And talking to other historians, and went on and confirmed that the lineage of Alabama State goes back to July 18th, 1867, instead of it becoming a state-supported institution in 1870 and 1874.
I wonder if I could get you to tell us something about what were called the Marion Nine, those nine people who founded this school.
Oh, man, they require a book themselves. These are nine black men, and I think, I have to go back, I think six of the nine could read and write, which is unusual. And I found that the reason was from reading that Bible, but it was a dangerous proposition to be caught with a pencil and paper during slavery. I think one minister said he would have been better to be caught with a hog than with a newspaper, because a hog would get you whipped, but a newspaper would get you hung. The other thing was that after the Civil War, just as the modern civil rights period, the leadership came from the black church. And so I tried to make that connection with the black church and these black men. And they are very distinguished, very professional. Let's start with Alexander Curtis, a senator, politician, mail clerk, businessman, barber. He was able to secure his freedom in 1859, running a barbershop, basically, and running the mercantile shop. He supposedly left and went to New York, but he must have returned immediately because he had three children be born in Marion in between the war. The other thing that stood out to me was finding that he paid taxes and federal taxes in 1865, so his business venture was going. But he's a leader of the National Baptist Convention, which is founded here in Montgomery in 1867 at First Baptist Church. He's involved in politics. He needs work, a book by himself. So I was simply fascinated with Alexander Curtis. Also, another, not a Marion Nine, but a key player, is a man, Thomas C. Stewart, the Union veteran officer who came south, was an agent of the AMA, and he led the way in building the buildings and organizing the school with the support of the black Marion community. The Nine was representative of the community. They put forth the money, the effort. Many were carpenters and had special trade that contributed to that early growth. And, of course, you know all about Reconstruction politics. It was a tough go for the freedmen. They was emancipated, but with very little room for advancement. They had to do it all on their own. And they had to rely upon the federal government, the American Missionary Association, the Freedmen Bureau, and radical Republicans in Congress.
Once they established this school, how successful was it? How many educated students did they turn out?
Well, when they had the, I think it's 1924, they celebrated the 75th reunion. They had identified 890 graduates. And some very distinguished graduates coming out through the school. There was such a need, as you know about normal schools. Normal schools, the concept came out of Germany in the 1830s because of the pervasiveness of literacy in the country. And so this common school system was established, and they decided to establish normal schools to develop teachers. And that's what Lincoln did. They turned out teachers mainly to teach in the black schools up the Alabama Black Belt, but they would venture all across the nation. And the university itself would become known as a teacher college, one of the best black teachers college in the nation. That was his mission. I tried to identify all of the graduates from 1880 up until 1924 in my appendix. So it's quite numerous. Some people you recognize, medical doctors, lawyers, black businessmen. That's what the school was done. Not only the Lincoln School, but the A&M School in Normal, Alabama, Huntsville. Also, we can't forget Tuskegee Institute and the Wills of Booker T. Washington.
Tuskegee and its history has a special interest for Joe Caver. In 2011, he co-authored the book, The Tuskegee Airmen, An Illustrated History. Booker T. Washington was the leader of the Tuskegee Normal and Industrial Institute, which is now Tuskegee University. In 1887, because of a fire on campus and pressure from local white Baptists, the Lincoln School was forced to move from Marion. Booker T. Washington was lobbying for the school to be moved to Birmingham, but he was unsuccessful. Instead, the Lincoln School moved to its current location, Montgomery, Alabama, just about 30 miles from Tuskegee.
Booker T. Washington tried to push Lincoln State Normal to Birmingham. The land investors out there in Eastlake did not want the school there, and that's how the school got to Montgomery against the wishes of Booker T. Washington, who looked upon the school as a threat to his institution. It was a religious conflict more so than a racial conflict. Of course, racism always at the core of a lot of this, but it was the white Baptist decision to move.
In the book, there are some terrific photographs of sports teams. How important was athletics to this school?
It was, at the turn of the century, it was big. Of course, they started the football program in 1901, about 3 or 4 years behind Talladega and Tuskegee. But my main interest was the minor league Negro Baseball League club that played here. And they was using State Normal as the site of their games. And football became big. And, of course, in 1924, the establishment of the Turkey Day Classic, Harper Council Trenum, then president, used the proceeds during the Depression to pay the teachers and staff. You have to wait till after the game to get paid. But it's an outlet. It also brings people together. And in later years, particularly in the 1970s, sports helped ease the trouble of integrating the culture that we live in. The rise of the marching bands would play a major role there. The music, you know, so we was talking about the difference in the white church and the black church. It also, you see it on the football field in the band performance, and much more upbeat, much more movement. Maybe not as much sound as you get with the 100, 200, 300, 400 pieces. But athletics and academics, they have been tied at the hip.
In the years after the school's move from Marion to Montgomery, the school became a junior college. In 1928, it became a full 4-year institution. In 1969, the State Board of Education, then the governing body of the university, approved a name change. The institution became Alabama State University. Today, the university serves over 600 students on a 172-acre campus and has an endowment of over $100 million. Again, the name of Joseph Caver's new book is From Marion to Montgomery, The Early Years of Alabama State University, 1867 to 1925. Students with a poor self-image and shaky coping skills may possibly be helped by theater studies. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Shakespeare and comedy might give at-risk youth a better path. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Adam Frank, professor of anthropology and performance studies, describes this research.
Does exposure to theater contribute to improved self-image, better coping skills, and reduced likelihood of recidivism for youth on probation in the Arkansas juvenile justice system. Over the last 3 years, approximately 50 juvenile probationers in Faulkner County have been mandated by the county juvenile court to participate in one of two theater workshop series in a collaboration between the court, the university, and a local theater company. The first 8-part workshop series has focused on using comedy improvisation and the theater of the oppressed techniques of Brazilian theater artist Augusto Boal to provide a space for teen participants to create short plays about community or social problems they wish to address. The second workshop series also starts with comedy improv, but focuses on using poetry and Shakespeare to tap into the expressive imagination. Currently under review by the university's Institutional Review Board, the research project is a qualitative study following up with past participants and court personnel to identify short and long-term outcomes of the workshops. Through questionnaires and in-depth interviews, probation officers and past workshop participants will have an opportunity to express their views on the effectiveness of the workshops. Measures of effectiveness will include actual rates of recidivism among participants, as well as subjective measures of satisfaction. The qualitative results will be compared to court-generated data gathered through SAVORY, the Structured Assessment of Violence Risk in Youth.
That was Adam Frank of Central Arkansas University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.